Okay, James chapter 2. Last time, if you remember, we started looking at this passage on favoritism. We saw that the church should welcome all people, irrespective of who they are, no matter what their worldly status might be. Whether they're rich or poor, famous or insignificant, doesn't really matter. The church should welcome one and all. And there's a danger that people who are regarded as less important in worldly terms may also be sidelined by the church. And that's something which James is saying we shouldn't do. Whereas perhaps on other occasions, people who perhaps are a bit more famous, maybe if somebody famous came into the church, we might, you know, want to be a bit excited about somebody being here. And the church might court the stars of the world, maybe. But that's something we shouldn't be doing. We should be regarding and treating everybody as equal. We did see as well in that passage in verses 1 to 7 that we looked at last time in chapter 2, that sometimes people even exploit the church for their own ends, to enhance their status in the world maybe, to make them look as though they're decent, upright, moral people. And even people exploit the church. We have to watch out for that too, that we don't get carried along with these things. We have to make sure that we welcome everybody equally without pandering to worldly whims. And what we realised at the end of it last, if you remember, was this, that the actions we demonstrate in these things betray our thinking, whether we think in a godly way or in a worldly way. And that's another important point as we go through James, that what we do is a demonstration of what we are, what we think, what our priorities are. Well, James now continues with this thought as he explores this a bit further in regard to people's obedience to the law. He quotes here Leviticus 19:18, "You shall love your neighbour as yourself." And he calls this the royal law because it encapsulates, if you like, everything that God wants us to know about our relationships, treating one another. In these few words, we find God's desire for all of our human relationships, that we love our neighbour as ourselves. Jesus, of course, also quoted this in Matthew chapter 22, verse 39, which along with it, what he says is the command to love God with all your heart, he says, sums up the whole of the law and the prophets. These two things. Loving God with all our hearts and loving our neighbour as ourselves. So this then is of supreme importance for us as Christians. Jesus says to us that the love we have for God must be extended to the people around us. And James is telling us again, that should be our overriding consideration in the way we live and in the relationships that we have. So what does that actually mean for us then in our everyday relationships? Who is our neighbour? Well, of course, Jesus again answered that in the parable of the Good Samaritan, didn't he? We all, I think, are fairly familiar with that parable where there was a Jew who was beaten up and left to die on the side of the road, and the good and the worldly good people, the rabbis and the teachers and the Pharisees, they just passed by ignoring him. And when along came a Samaritan, the enemies of the Jews, and he looked after him, made sure he was catered for and looked after, didn't he? And Jesus was saying in that parable that everyone is our neighbour. Not just the people we like or respect, not the people we look up to or think are good, but everyone is our neighbour. Doesn't matter about race, creed, colour or social status. Everyone is our neighbour. And I suppose that if we're to love others as we love ourselves, perhaps we should think about the way we love ourselves. How do we do that? How do you love yourself? I suspect, if you're like most people, you treat yourself fairly well. You do what you can to make sure that life is fairly comfortable, don't you? You don't go out of your way to make things difficult or painful for you. We make sure, don't we, that we have life's necessities as best we can. We feed ourselves and clothe ourselves. We try to look after our health. make sure we've got somewhere to live. We like to have family and friends around us. We like to have relationships. All in all, what we try to do is to make life as pleasant as we possibly can in our circumstances. If that's the way we treat ourselves, that's the way we should treat others. Are we prepared to do that for others? Are we prepared to do what we can to make other people's lives comfortable? Now, I realise that we cannot meet every need in this world. We just can't do that. And in some ways, it's harder today, isn't it? Where we have global communications, we instantly know any need that goes on in the world. The earthquake in Haiti. Again, we knew instantly what was going on. We saw the needs on our television screens. And so in some ways it's harder for us as Christians because we cannot possibly meet every need in this world. In fact, Jesus himself said to his disciples, didn't he? There will be poor always. We can't do everything. What we should be doing is meeting the needs we can where we're able in the circumstances we find ourselves in. You know, what God expects of us is that if we meet or find somebody in need in some way and we have the ability to help, then we should not ignore them. We should always ask ourselves, what would I hope that others would do for me if I was in that situation? That's what we should be asking ourselves. There is something, though, that exceeds the practical help we have to offer. And that is the love we have in sharing the gospel message. Last week we were thinking about how gaining material things is futile if ultimately we lose our souls. And it's true, isn't it? Material things are temporary, they don't last forever. But our soul is eternal, and that's what really matters. You know, we can demonstrate love to people in helping people in material ways, but that love can ultimately be futile if we fail to tell them the gospel message. I'd go as far as to say that we can dedicate our whole lives to meeting people's physical needs. We can sacrifice our own comfort and security to do so. But if we fail to address their spiritual needs, then we have not shown true love. And ultimately, it will be futile. It might make life a bit more comfortable in a temporary sense, but will it save their soul in an eternal sense? The greatest need that any single person has is the spiritual need to be right with God. No matter what their physical circumstances, the greatest need anyone has is to be right spiritually with God. It would be better to spend a few years here in poverty and suffering than it would be to spend eternity in suffering. If there is ever a choice between meeting the physical needs of a person and meeting the spiritual needs of a person, the spiritual must take priority, because that goes into eternity. And I don't say it lightly. And we'll see the next passage in James, actually, how important it is to help people in physical ways. And that is a demonstration, again, of our faith. But the eternal must take priority over the temporary. It must do. Otherwise, it's all futile. You see, we can always meet people's spiritual needs because we have the gospel message. We can always meet people's spiritual needs. But we may not always be able to help with their physical needs. So James tells us that we need to love others as ourselves. And that involves helping them physically, but more importantly, helping them spiritually. And if we don't do this, or, he says, if we show favouritism in doing this, then we fail. Do you remember, if you've seen The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe? There's a section that Lucy, one of the children, is given a little bottle of liquid that helps to heal people who've been injured in battle. And when they have the big battle at the end of the book, Edward gets injured. And Lucy comes along and she's really worried about Edward, and she gives him some of the liquid and he gets better. And she's just there, sort of sitting around comforting him. And Aslan comes and says to her, "Okay, you've looked after Edward, but there are other people out there who need your help." And that's what we mustn't do either. We mustn't forget the others and get focused upon perhaps the people who are our favourites. James makes quite a radical statement here. He says that failure to do this, failure to love our neighbours as ourselves, failure to be obedient to this law of love, means that we are lawbreakers. It means that we're lawbreakers. Well, you might think that, you know, failing on one aspect isn't too much of a problem. And that's how people think, isn't it? You know, I've done something minor wrong, but I've not done anything really bad. I may have, you know, perhaps stolen a pen from work, or I've told a lie to somebody, a white lie, but I've not murdered anybody. I'm okay, really. You know, the Jews especially regarded themselves as righteous through the law, or through obedience to the law. There's a parable in Luke chapter 18. Let's just turn to Luke 18 for a moment, the parable there of the Pharisee, the tax collector, in Luke 18 and verse 9. Let's read it, because it's only short, and it says this: "To some who are confident of their own righteousness and look down on everybody else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood up and prayed about himself, 'God, I thank you that I am not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get.' But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, 'God, have mercy on me, a sinner.' I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." That shows the mentality of the religious people of the day. They thought because they were doing the right things as they saw it, fasting, giving a tenth, not doing anything dreadfully wrong, they thought they were okay. But Jesus points out that they're not. We might have that same attitude. I've done all right. I'm not a really bad person. You know, I've kept the law as best I can. But when we think that way, it shows a misunderstanding of God's law. My computer is made up of lots of parts. It's got a motherboard, CPU, that's central processing unit, memory, hard drives, monitor, all these bits make up a computer. If one of those bits goes wrong, the whole computer's useless. I can't use it. If I lose one of those bits, the rest, although they might be okay, the whole thing doesn't function properly. If we fail on one bit, we fail on the whole. That's what James here says about the law. You fail in one aspect, you've broken the lot. And that's the way it is. You see, the Ten Commandments shouldn't be seen as individual laws that we have to try and keep, but they should be seen rather as a whole. By breaking one part, we've broken the whole. You can't come to God and say, "I've only done a few things wrong." That's what we call the balance book mentality. You know, I've done a few bad things, but I've done many more good things. And obviously, God's going to weigh it all up at the end, and if the good things outweigh the bad things, then we're okay. It doesn't work that way. By failing on one aspect, we fail on it all. As soon as we've broken God's law, There's nothing we can do to put it right again. I got a favourite sweatshirt, one of my favourite sweatshirts, and one day I got some drops of bleach on it. Only a few little drops, but it's no good now. I still wear it actually, but it's not really any good. It's damaged. The whole thing is really not as nice as it should be. Just a couple of drops of bleach is all it took to ruin the whole thing. That's like sin. You haven't got to do a lot wrong. One thing is enough. We can't go back and undo the sin we've done. I can't go back and get the bleach out of my sweatshirt. I've tried, doesn't work. Once you've sinned, you have become a sinner. You are a lawbreaker. And the consequence of doing that is judgment. The consequence of breaking God's law is judgment. It means it doesn't matter what we've done wrong, whether it's a lie or a murder. We are all lawbreakers. No one is better in God's sight than anyone else. And the truth is, God has given us the law to show us how far short we fall of what he requires. It shows us how far short of God's standard we really are. And none of us are able to come anywhere near living up to God's perfect standard, because God requires perfection. That is what he demands. You might say that's a bit too much. God expects too much of us to be perfect. It's impossible. Yes, it is impossible. But perfection is the standard that God has set. That is what he created us to be. He created us to be perfect. And it's only sin that has changed that. And because of sin, none of us will ever reach that perfect requirement. We all fall short of the entrance requirement to heaven, if you like. All of us. All of us has deliberately sinned by ignoring God and going our own way. And as soon as that happens, we become sinners and we cannot do anything to change it, ever. Once we've broken the law, we are lawbreakers. And justice demands judgment. And the law that God has set down says that judgment is to be eternal death, separation from God for eternity. But there is hope. There is hope. And that hope, James tells us, relies on God's mercy. The hope relies on God's mercy. Let's think for a minute about God's judgment and mercy, which James looks at in the last couple of verses here. Justice requires judgment, and judgment results in punishment. Okay, justice requires judgment, and judgment results in punishment. As God is a just God, he cannot simply overlook our sin. For justice to be done, a penalty has to be paid. Suppose I was caught for speeding. And there I am, up before the judge. All the evidence has been heard, and it's quite clear I'm guilty of the crime. So I'm found guilty, and the judge has to pass sentence. He's obliged to do that so that justice might be done. The sentence is passed. The judge orders me to pay a fine of £500. Now, because I'm a part-time pastor, I have clearly no way of paying such a huge fine. The judge is well aware of this, and he can see that I just couldn't pay this penalty. He could simply say, well, it's your own fault. You knew that if you broke the speed limit, you'd have to pay a penalty, so tough luck. Nothing wrong with that. That's fair. That's just. But maybe He's a merciful judge. In the court, I may have acknowledged my crime, pleaded guilty, begged the court's forgiveness, and I might hope that he's simply going to let me off. But he can't. He can't do that. Unless the penalty gets paid, justice will not be done. So the judge looks upon me with compassion and mercy. And he decides that he's going to pay the fine for me. The crime's been committed. The sentence has been passed. And now the price has been paid and justice has been done. God looks upon us with mercy because he loves us. He looks upon us with compassion and mercy because he loves us. And his love is demonstrated by his action. His action was that he gave his son to take the punishment for us. And that's why James says mercy overcomes judgment. But justice has been done. And that's really important. Because God is a God of justice, and you can never forego his justice. Mercy overcomes judgment, but it doesn't overcome justice. Make no mistake, we're all guilty. The sentence has been passed, and we deserve eternal damnation. But God, because he loves us, looks upon our need in mercy. And he pays the price himself so that we don't have to. He gives his son to take our punishment. And that is how much God loves us. What James is saying here, bearing in mind this is written to believers who are no longer under judgment and condemnation because they've put their trust and faith in Jesus. The point James is trying to make here is this. Since we have been shown mercy by God, we too should show that same mercy to others. And this is another example of how our Christian faith should be demonstrated in practical living. Rather than seeking personal retribution if somebody offends us, we should be prepared to show mercy just as we have been shown mercy. That other parable Jesus told about the unmerciful servant in Matthew 18. It's clear from that we are expected to be merciful to others as God has been merciful to us. That's what Jesus expects of us. So here again, as we look at this teaching from James, he's telling us how we should be living, which demonstrates the genuineness of our faith. We should love our neighbour. That requires us to do our best for people in need. Physically, but more important, spiritually. We have to acknowledge that we've broken God's law, that none of us are better than anyone else. We all stand condemned before a holy God. And yet through God's great love, and his great mercy, and his grace, we're able to be free from the consequence of our sin, because Christ has already paid the price on our behalf. If we will acknowledge our sin, if we will repent before God, God himself will pay the price for my sin and for your sin. The price that gives us freedom. And once we know that forgiveness, once we know that love, once we know that mercy, we too should exhibit the same thing to those around us.